You are listening to the Passion City Church podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at passioncitychurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart, and it's part of a new series about Jonah.
Well, several years ago, a guy by the name of Steve Callahan, after a terrible boating accident, was lost at sea by himself in a little rubber life raft for 76 days, 2.5 months alone in a little raft somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. And so he started starving to death, became emaciated, got dazed, disoriented, and yet in the middle of all that, he had the sense to take 3 pencils and lash them together and create a sextant, which is a nautical tool you can use to get your bearings by measuring the distance between the sun and the horizon. And so it was based on his understanding of these fixed realities in the universe, he was able to discern what latitudinal line he was on the globe. And then he paddled into the right current and floated safely into the Caribbean and had a nice vacation, because it's lovely there, right? And he wrote a best-selling book, and he's doing fine, right? Now, why tell you that story? For this reason. It was his understanding of fixed realities about the universe that helped him navigate the uncertain waters of his life well, right? And you go, why bring that up? Because this morning, I want to show you 2 fixed realities about the universe that are true for all of us, that if you can get your mind around them, understand them, they're going to help you navigate your life, whatever season of life you might be in. And the first reality is this, that there is a tendency in us to resist the leadership of God. That we're all made in God's image, that we're made to walk with him, be a part of what he's doing. There's a tendency in us to resist the leadership of God, to run from him. And it doesn't make any sense. To pursue life by running away from the source of life does not make sense. But we do it. We're like me when I went to camp. So I don't know if any of you ever went to summer camp. Anybody go to summer camp as a kid? It's a participational church. There you are. Okay, yeah, some of you went. I don't know what kind of camps you went to. For me, I went to summer camp every year in Mississippi, and they were on college campuses. So they weren't like a lot of y'all's camps where they were like ropes courses and friendship and things like that. You would just kind of walk around this college campus for a while. And so the highlight of camp every year was the Sadie Hawkins race. And what they would do, if you never participated in one, they would line up all the boys at the edge of a field, and when they blew the whistle, all the boys would run out into the field. And then they would line all the girls up, blow the whistle, and the girls had to run out there, chase the boy of their choice, tag them, and then take them on a date. Yeah, which in hindsight, I think was a little awkward for the girls. But it was tough for the guys, because, you know, you could get in that moment where you're running and looking, nobody's chasing you, right? Yeah, which happened. But I'm married now, so I'm fine. I win. It's not good, right? But I remember it was like my 8th grade year, something like that. I got reliable intel that one of the upperclassmen girls was going to chase me. Now, it was a mercy thing, right? But I knew that. And she was cute, so I didn't care, right? So help me with this, class. If you know one of the nicest, cutest girls is about to chase you, when they blow that whistle, what do? You lay up. You're like, oh, leg cramp. You slow down. You're like, all right? And then that's it. You win. But for some reason, they blew that whistle, and I started to run. And not only did I run as she caught up to me because she was fast, I began to dodge and slip and move until finally she had to clothesline me in the neck to get me to stop. And then we went to dinner and had a marvelous time, right? And you go, why did you do that? Well, it was my insanity to run from her. And it was her kindness to chase me. And that's the second reality. The first is there's a tendency in all of us to resist the leadership of God. And the Bible has a name for that. It calls it sin. But the second reality, and the good news is, there's a tendency in God to chase us and to interrupt our self-destructive behavior. And the Bible calls that grace. And around those 2 realities, the universe orbits. It's the theme of the scripture. It's the theme of your life and mine. Sin and grace, running and chasing, right? And it's the theme of the book of Jonah. So as you look at the book of Jonah, if you're one of those people that likes your outline ahead of time, you're like, where's my little outline that I'm supposed to fill out? Let me just tell you what it is. God calls, Jonah runs. God pursues, Jonah surrenders. That's where we're going. God calls Jonah to run with him. Come be a part of what I'm doing, Jonah. And he does it in verse 1. It says, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, arise and go to Nineveh, the great city. Cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. Now, by way of introduction, Jonah was a prophet, somebody that knew God and somebody that spoke to God for the people. We found that out in 2 Kings. And so Jonah was a man who knew this, to be a part of what God's doing. And God's telling him here, be a part of what I'm doing, Jonah. But then he calls him to go to Nineveh. And it calls it the great city because it was the capital city of the greatest, most powerful, also most violent nation of that day, right? And so Nineveh was an intimidating place, a massive city, a dangerous city. It was the neighboring city to Israel where Jonah lived. And the Assyrians hated the Israelites, right? And they hated them right back. And so what God was calling Jonah to do in Jonah's defense was kind of crazy. He was saying, go to the massive center of the great military might that hates you. They hate the Jews and you're a Jew, but go there and preach against them. It would be crazy. This was in Assyria, which is modern day Iraq. This was right across the way from Mosul, where God's calling him. And it felt a little crazy to Jonah, like I would imagine it would to you if God came to you and said, hey, go to Mosul, go to the exact same place and preach Jesus. You'd be like, what? No, I don't think I heard you right. It felt a little crazy, right? And yet the reality is adventure always starts with a little bit of crazy. And yet God is always writing a bigger story than we would write. If you normally look at your own story, it usually involves accumulating a little bit of power, a little bit of fame, a little bit of money, and a little bit of comfort, and I win, right? And God has more for you than that. God is calling us to more than that. And he looks at Jonah and says, be a part of what I'm doing. I'm about to change history, Jonah, and I want you to be a part of that. I want your life to mean something. Come with me, Jonah, run with me. And yeah, it sounds crazy, but amazing always starts with daring. So let's go. Jonah responds in verse 3. But Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa, found a ship, which was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Now, the book of Jonah is written with a lot of humor in it, and Hebrew humor is plays on words. And you get your first one here, the irony that it's the exact same language. God says, arise and go. So it says, Jonah arose and fled, right? And you're supposed to read that like Jonah's like, yes, Lord, wait, what is that? And takes off, right? And he runs, and he goes to Tarshish. Now, if you look at a map, it's clear what's going on here. And I don't know if we got one. Oh, there's a map. So Jonah lived here, right? And God calls him to go to Nineveh, which is there. And he goes to Tarshish, which is there, right? We got it? Tarshish? Is it on there? Let me know when you see it, because I can't see it. Anybody? Tarshish? Can't see it. All right. Well, if you go a little far left there, you see the Spain. That's where Tarshish is. So he's not confused. He's not a little bit like, oh, I thought you said Nashville. What am I doing on this boat? Like, literally, God said, go left. And he's like, okay. And he goes right. He goes the exact opposite direction that God calls him. And another way the text draws you to it is, I don't know if it sounded like the text read a little weird, like a little bit of clunky language. Some people read that and be like, oh, that's just the Bible being weird again. But the truth is, in Hebrew, there was also a way you could do memory devices with the words, and one of them was called a chiasm. It's where you make the top of a sentence and the bottom of a sentence parallel each other, and they sort of parallel until they get to the middle of the sentence, which is the main point. And it's called a chiasm because a chi is an X, and it kind of builds to the center of the X. Everybody got that? Not remember it? Who cares? But anyway, as you read it, the balance of the text is this. It starts with to Tarshish from the Lord, and it ends with to Tarshish from the Lord. He went down to Joppa. He went down to the ship. He found a ship. He paid the ship's fare, and then at the center, it's I'm going to Tarshish. Three times. I'm going to Tarshish, I'm going to Tarshish, I'm going to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. I believe there's a God up there, I believe he has purposes, but I wanna run my own life, so I'm going this way. And here's the thing. We all do this. We all do this. Humanity has done this. You see in the book of Genesis, in Genesis 1, as God creates the world, he takes chaos and he puts it into order. And not just order, he creates a garden called delight. And he creates a man or a woman. And the first command he gives them is eat, eat, eat freely. Actually, the first command he gives them is eat and multiply, which my little kid's Bible that we read to our kids that has an audio version, that guy says, have babies. That's how he translates it, which is true. Eat and have babies. Two of humanity's favorite things to do were the first two commands of God. Enjoy the world I've made. But then he makes a tree called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he says, but all professions of love must be tested. And so let me test you. Let me just see. There's one thing I don't want you to do. And that's the one thing humanity finds intolerable. And it's not that they wanted to experientially know what evil felt like. The knowledge of the good and evil was, I get to be the one who decides what's right or wrong. That's what was so evil about it. God, you want to be Lord over all this. I don't want you to be Lord over me. I'm the Lord over me. I'm the captain of my own ship. I'm the captain of my own soul. You don't tell me what to do. I tell you what's good, bad, right, or wrong. I'll do whatever I want. And you see humanity do that by Genesis chapter 3 and by Genesis 4 and 5. What do you see? A proliferation of violence and the degradation of women for sexual exploitation. You see our newspaper. You see human history. We run away from the author of life thinking we'll find it, and what we get is death. What we get is loss. That's humanity. And here's the thing. We all do it. We all do it. It's fascinating. I listened to a report on NPR. I don't know if you listen to NPR. I don't know if I do, but I listened to this one. And it was about the Kennedy Center here in town. And it was back in the 70s when the Kennedy Center was just getting rolling and had a gift shop. And they found that the gift shop was hemorrhaging money, that it was losing $150,000 worth of cash and merchandise every single year. 40% of its profits were disappearing, not making it to the bank. And so they had to figure out, what's going on with the gift shop, man? And so they hired a detective, Detective Lovelace, which makes it sound like I'm making the story up, but I promise I'm not. They hired Detective Lovelace, and he starts analyzing people. And there's all kinds of people that work there. Like the manager was 21. There was all kinds of people of different ages and ethnicities and backgrounds. A lot of the people that worked there were retirees that just wanted to support the arts. And so they were there for free, just supporting the arts. There was all kinds of age ranges, whatever, elderly, young, everybody. And they were all in there. And they were like, we got to figure out who's stealing this money. And so they're like, it's probably the guy who takes the cash box from the Kennedy Center to the bank. And so they set up a sting operation, put marked bills in there, literally hid in the bushes, waited for the guy, tackled him, checked his pockets, marked bills were there, $60. Caught him. But you go, that's $60 accounted for. That still leaves $149,940 left unaccounted for. So they started changing their accounting practices, changing some structural patterns just to try to catch who the bad guy was that was stealing the money. And do you know who they found out was stealing? Everybody. Everybody. Elderly patrons would just take a shirt if they thought it looked cool. Young people would grab a couple bucks for cab fare. They were trying to figure out who the culprit was. And you know who it was? Everybody. And the guy in the interview was like, that's when I figured out that I don't care if you're in a tuxedo and a supporter of arts, everybody's evil, right? Everybody runs. Now, does that mean all sin is the same? No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying everything you do, like if you murder or you steal a t-shirt, it's all the same. It's not all the same. I think murder's like worse. But what I'm trying to say is everybody's guilty. Everybody runs. That's all I'm trying to say, right? And some of the best self-knowledge you can have is knowing how you do it. We know how Jonah did it. He went down to Joppa, found a ship that was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down. That's how he did it. He said, I'm running from God. Here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to Joppa first, and then I'm going to hang a left. He starts mapping it out. The best self-knowledge you can have is saying, if everybody tends to do this, how do I do it? The Apostle Paul said, I covet. Apostle Paul, who wrote much of the New Testament, he said back in the day, people were reading to him the laws of God, and he was like, done it, crushing it, nailed it. And he said, when they got to coveting, he was like, ooh, coveting is seeing somebody have what I want. And not just wanting it, but resenting you for having it. Yeah. You ever felt that? Is that too honest? Do you ever know someone who's felt that? You ever notice we don't covet people who are different than us? You know what I mean? If some guy's dentist practice is blowing up, you're like, awesome. You know, like you don't care. But if they're too close to you, like same age or education or skill set, and they're winning, you're just like, congratulations, bub. You know, it's like, it's hard to celebrate them. Some of you know what that's like. You're the funny guy in your group. That's where you get your little endorphin kick. You like it when people think you're funny, and so you're standing around with your friends, and someone else tells a joke, and everyone laughs, and you're like, I hate that guy. I don't trust him. He needs to die. He can't be here. Or you're used to being the cute one that always looks amazing. You got your outfit on point, and so you show up in a group, and suddenly some other girl, they're like, you look amazing. You're so cute. And you're like, yeah, you should get hit by a bus in that. Wait, what? Did I say that? Like, oh, like, I don't like seeing other people win. We typically don't say that out loud, but we feel it, right? We say it, right? Something wrong with us. Elijah said, it's my mouth. Elijah was a religious guy. Elijah was part of the religious system. I'm doing all the holy stuff I'm supposed to do, blah, blah, blah. But when he really had an encounter with God, when God really pressed in, past all the show, but I'm really face to face with God, the first thing he said was, woe to me. I am a man of unclean lips. He said, when it gets real, the way I use my mouth tears down, it doesn't build up. It hurts people, it doesn't help people. I gossip, I say mean things, I complain, which poisons the culture. He said, I got a mouth problem. Other people, it's a lust problem. Augustine, who historians believe is one of the greatest minds in history, certainly the second greatest theologian to the Apostle Paul, is what they said. When he really got honest with God, he said, I'm a sex addict. He's like, man, and the way I pursue, he was successful in oratory, successful financially, successful in business, so he thought he was killing it all, but he was absolutely out of control of his sexual impulses, and it hurt people, and he realized I couldn't control it, and he broke him, right? Some of us, it's unforgiveness. You have parents that weren't great, and that's not your fault, but you hold on to resentment because it makes you feel strong, and that's the problem. Some of you, it's insecurity. You beat yourself up, self-loathing, and there's a certain comfort that comes in a victim status. I don't know what it is for you. I just know everybody runs. And the best self-knowledge you can have is knowing how you do it. And here's the sad thing. There will always be a boat. There will always be a boat to take you to Tarshish. You want to go there. You want to have an unbounded sexuality? There will always be a site you can click on or a person you can exploit. There always will be. You want to hold on to bitterness? There will always be something to resent. You want to complain? There will always be something not going your way. You want to compare and analyze? There will always be fuel for your self-consciousness. There'll always be a boat going to Tarshish, right? And Jeremiah the prophet said, my people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, the well of living water, God says, and they've gone to cisterns, broken cisterns that can't hold water. And that's the story of humanity, that we're made for him. We run after many vain things. Now the question is, what does God do with a people like that? What's he gonna do to you? What would you do? You got a buddy that's had too much to drink, stumbling towards the car with the keys. What do you say? Good luck. Drive fast, you'll get home quicker. No, what do? You say, give me the keys, man. No, bro, give me the keys. Give me the keys. And you tackle him. You take him out. You say, if I care about you, I'm going to stop this process, right? And I don't care if it hurts your feelings in the midst of it. Is God going to let Jonah go? Head to Tarshish? Fine, take off. You're a loser. Amos, you're up. Is that what he's going to do? No. He's going to chase him, right? He's coming after him. Hebrews 12 says, the one the Lord loves, he disciplines, right? I don't discipline the neighbor's kids. I don't know them. I discipline mine because I love him. And God's going to come after Jonah. And look at how he does it, because this is how he's going to do it to you, right? The Lord hurled a great wind on the sea, and there was a great storm on the sea so that the ship was about to break up. Sometimes to get you see the problem, God will introduce pain. And he won't do it to hurt you. He'll do it to help you. So I remember one time when I went to camp, later in ministry, I walked into this dorm room with a buddy of mine, and there was a dove that had gotten trapped in the dorm, right? And the dove was on the window ledge trying to get out, but it didn't understand glass. So it was just like, and just like smacking against the glass. I'm like, I'm trying to get there and I can't. Why is it not working? Right? And so he was freaking out and had gone to the bathroom all over the ledge and himself. And it was not his best moment. And so pity struck our hearts for this little dove. We're like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And so I got this like warm Disney feeling of like, I'm going to help this bird. And I will pick him up in my gentle hands and I will release him into the wild and he will fly away and experience freedom and turn back and have a single tear and then go and tell all the rest of the doves of the kindness and benevolence of this giant. And I just thought it was going to be amazing. So I reached down to him and as you can probably imagine, it freaks him out. And so he starts scraping me and flinging poop on me and I'm like, I hate you already, right? And so my buddy takes the floor mat off the floor and he curls it in a semicircle and just goes and pins the dove to the window. And then he rolls it into a cylinder, which constrains the bird. Now it's really freaking out. I got less freedom and I'm surrounded by darkness. And then he begins to move. Bird doesn't know what's going on. All he knows is I'm out of control and it's dark and I'm scared. He's freaking out. What he doesn't understand is my buddies slide him towards the door. And when he's ready, he opens the mat and the dove flies free. Sometimes God in his mercy will send a storm, not to hurt you, but to help you. You are going away that's not working. So in love, I will rock your boat. Right? That's what God does. Right? What kind of storms will he send you? I don't know. I'll tell you too. Some of you, he will not give you what you want. You were like, I want this certain position. I want this certain notoriety. I want this certain amount of money. I want this certain acceptance. I want this person to like me. I want this thing to work out. I want this, and God won't give it to you. And you will rage and rage and rage and rage until you realize this is not going to work for you anyway. It's not going to solve the deepest issues in you. Right? Others of you, the storm he'll send, and I think this one's scarier, is he'll give you everything you want. And you will be in Tarshish and feel very empty and very cold. Man, that's what I just heard in the latest Chainsmokers song. You know, these guys are blowing up. I mean, they have had every bit of success they want as a band. And his latest song is, I post a picture of myself because I'm lonely. Everyone already knows what I look like, but nobody really knows me. So I walk into the club like everybody hates me. That's the refrain over and over again. Walk into the club like everybody hates me. And you're like, this is the saddest thing ever. I got everything I want, and it's Jay-Z, it's the Holy Grail. I got it, and the best I can sing is, I guess I'm still alive. And some of us, that's the storm God will send you, and he'll do it because he cares about you. But that doesn't mean it'll be easy, and what I love about this is the humor too. It says the ship threatened to break up. It's really the only time in the Bible that it ascribes thinking to an inanimate object. And it's kind of a joke. It's like, this storm is so bad that the ship is like, this is horrible, right? Like the ship itself is like, we're not gonna make it. And the sailors freak out. Verse 5 says, the sailors get afraid. Every man cried to his God. They start getting religious. And they threw the cargo, which was in the ship, into the sea to lighten it for them. They're letting go of everything. God help us. But then it says, but Jonah had gone below into the hold of the ship, laid down, and fallen asleep. This is fascinating. Storm's destroying the boat. Jonah's going down into the boat, falling asleep. You're like, how's he sleeping? For me in ministry, I've seen this because I was a youth pastor back in the day, and every now and again, I'll run into those kids everywhere, DC, everywhere. And I can usually tell within the first 5 minutes how they're doing, how their walk with God is, how they're doing spiritually, because as soon as they see me, I can tell by their vibrancy. Some of them walk right up and are like, hey, it's good to see you. Oh my gosh, you won't believe this. God's doing this in my life. I'm doing this. I'm a part of this. God's moving. It's amazing. And there's just this energy to them. Or I'll see others that when they see me, they break eye contact, won't look at me, and their voice drops, and you can just feel this lack of energy. You don't feel great about where your life is. And one of the plays on words in this text is when Jonah decides to run from God, there's a repetition, and it's the word down. He went down to Joppa, down into the ship, down into the hold, fell down and went to sleep. As you run away from God, your life doesn't go up, it goes down. It's not gonna work for you. And it's not working for him. And that's the picture of our world, if I can be honest. So many people, we start to do things we think will bring us life, and they bring us a bit of shame, a bit of guilt, a bit of sadness. We begin to move away from God. And while the world is hemorrhaging in pain, and while the winds and waves are shaking the world, oftentimes the people of Jesus are wrapped up feeling sorry for ourselves down in the hold of the ship. And what I'm hoping and I'm praying for our church is that we would do what the captain's going to tell Jonah. Arise, get up, and call on your God. I know too many people who know Jesus that they start making mistakes, they do something stupid, they get back into some old patterns, or they move to a city where nobody's celebrating Jesus like them, and so they just curl up in the bottom of the ship and just became a little bit of a victim. And meanwhile, the world is hemorrhaging and the seas are raging, and they need a prophet to do something. And so God in his mercy sends a pagan sailor. Man of God's downstairs. Captain comes up and approaches him and says, "How is it that you're sleeping? Get up. Call on your God. Perhaps your God will be concerned about us so that we will not perish." What do you do when you realize everybody runs and so have I? Can I give you a couple things before we wrap up? First thing you do, face God. Just stop running. Just stop and turn and face him. And there's an irony in this. Did you notice? God said, "Arise and go." So Jonah arises and flees. And then he sends this pagan sailing captain to say, "Arise and call out on your God." It says the same word to him, right? Not arise and get back over and start over. Not arise and be like you were back when you were a kid. Not arise and do whatever your mom and dad hoped you would be. It just says arise, and right here at the bottom of the ship, right here with the water filling up and in the stench of it all, Jonah, just turn and look at him. And many of you, that's what you're doing here. And I love that. And I pray that this church will be a place where people, no matter what hold of what ship, what city you're on the way to, you would know that wherever you are, you can rise and face God. Let's be honest with him, right? Meanwhile, the sailors are trying to figure out whose fault it is. And so it says in verse 7, each man says to his mate, "Come, let us cast lots so we may learn on whose account this calamity has struck us." So they cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. I don't know if I really want to explain what a lot is. It's kind of like, I don't know if you, when I was a kid, we had magic eight balls. Do you remember those? Little toy where you would ask a question and then shake it and the little answer would come up, be like, "Am I supposed to date this person?" Look at it. "Not right now." Probably not a good idea. Right, and you just kind of wait till they give you the answer you want. They kind of had a version of that. Whose fault is this? Jonah, right? And so they get to Jonah, and they ask him in verse 8, "Tell us now, on whose account has this calamity struck us? What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What country? What people are you?" They're looking at Jonah, it's like, "Is this your fault? Who are you?" And what I love in this moment is Jonah does the second thing. Not only does he face God, I'm going to be honest with God now. He admits who he is. There's no like, "What? No, I'm as shocked as you." There's none of that. There's no like, "I don't control the wind and weather. I'm a victim too." There's none of that. He just admits who he is. And for him in verse 9, he says to them, "I'm a Hebrew and I fear the Lord God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land." Hebrew was another name for the Israelite people, and it called to mind, we're the rescued ones. We're the ones that were in bondage in Egypt, and God came and got us and set us free. He said, "I'm one of those." And then he says, "I fear the Lord God who made the sea and the dry land." So wherever you are in life, whether you've been running away from God since you were a kid, or maybe you just had a bad week, or maybe since you moved to DC, things derailed for you, I don't know. Wherever you are in the mix, if you're looking and saying, "I don't think I'm where I'm supposed to be," you pick your head up and say, "Okay, God," and you acknowledge who I am. For some of you, you might say, "You know what? I am a child of God," like Kenny was singing. I do know him. I've just not been living like it. Maybe you guys, it's just been a bad week. I just found myself in Joppa and it's just been a bad run. Maybe you're like, "Dude, I live in Tarshish. Like I run the Tarshish General Store. Like I have been here for a bit." I don't know. But you just look up. Say, "I'm gonna acknowledge God, call out to him. God, I'm here. And I'm gonna admit who I am." And if it's a follower of Jesus, say, "I'm a follower of Jesus, but I'm not looking like it." Or if you're not, maybe you just say, "You know what? Somebody made me. So I may not be a follower of Jesus, but I'm a creation of somebody. And I showed up in church because maybe that somebody has something to say to me about what life's about." And that's a great place to start. And we love that you're here with us asking those kind of questions. Just arise and admit who you are. God, what do you want? Jonah gets honest. We should too. And I love it. He gets honest with them in verse 10. It says, then the men became extremely frightened. And they said, how could you do this? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he told them. You go, what's going on with that? You're like, one, that had to be weird that they asked him earlier. So man, what are you doing on the ship? Business, pleasure, we're heading to Tarshish. Running from the Lord. Whatever, man. And they don't care. Now they're frightened. Why? Because he adds that little added detail. I fear the Lord who made the sea and the dry land. That's what confuses them. They look at him and they're like, you're running from the God of the sea on a boat? On my boat? What's the matter with you? That makes no sense. And that makes about as much sense as when we do it. You're gonna run from God? Well, I was living for God back when I lived down south, but now I'm here, this is a different scene. Y'all don't know it. I gotta live different up here. You think God's not up here? You think God's like, where did he go? You think God lost Jonah? Some little angels working the sonar like, Lord, we've lost him. We lost the prophet somewhere in Eastern Europe. He's gone. You think so? You think God can't see you just because the lights are down low? You don't think he knows what you've been up to? You don't think he knows already? He sees you. There's no surprises here. You're not admitting it to inform him. You're admitting it to release you. And they look and say, it makes no sense to believe there's a God, a source of life, and not be engaging with him, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't. And so they go, man, Jonah, what are you doing? And they ask him in verse 11, what should we do to you that the sea may become calm for us? And he gives us our next thing. He confesses what he's done. Pick me up, throw me in the sea. The sea will become calm for you. For I know that on account of me, this great storm has come upon you. I face God. I admit who I am. I'm made in your image, and I'm not acting like it. And I confess what I've done. I ran. And he says, this is my fault. He doesn't blame shift. Doesn't like, hey, I'm not the boat captain. Hey, I didn't do this. He just says, this is on me. Now, does that mean everything bad in your life is your fault? No. Your parents' divorce, not your fault. Your decision to harbor resentment and bitterness, that's on you. And so I'm not asking you to admit everything that's bad in your life. It's your fault. It's not. But there's some things we can look and say, but you know what? If everybody runs, this is how I do it. And yeah, maybe he ran further. Maybe I got as far as Joppa. But we all run. And this is how I do it. And he admits it. And the last thing he does is he surrenders. The guys try to save him, which is beautiful. Verse 13, the men rowed desperately. They don't want to throw him out of the boat. They rowed desperately to return to land, but they could not, for the sea was getting even stormier. Then they called on the Lord and said, we earnestly pray, O Lord, do not let us perish on account of this man's life. Do not put innocent blood on us, for you, O Lord, have done as you pleased. What's interesting about that is beforehand, they had been calling out the gods and throwing stuff overboard. They'd been doing whatever they could to try to control the storms in their life. But when the man of God gets honest about his sin, do you notice they start calling out to the Lord? Sometimes you run into people who follow Jesus and say, I can't admit I'm a failure because all my friends think I'm the one who has it all together. And if they find out I really don't, they may not trust me. Let me let you in on something. They know you don't have it all together. And if you admit it, it might make them start praying. That when the Christian gets honest about our sin as a culture, about our transgressions and what we've done that's not right, the poor we didn't care about, the people we didn't notice, the things we got into and tried to hide, when the Christian's honest that we're a mess too, it actually invites the sailors to come engage a God who could forgive even them because he forgave us, right? So they began to pray. Jonah says, throw me over. And they throw, we're about to throw him over prayer. And what I love about that is some people look at this and they go, is this a suicide mission? Is this Jonah being a cry? I guess it got me. So throw me in the water. No. He said, God's the God of the sea. Throw me to him. It's just a surrender. What are the mechanics of how this is going to work? I don't know. What's going to happen when you get there? I don't have that mapped out. I just know I'm his and I haven't been acting like it. So throw me to him. And that's about all you have to have figured out. If you're sitting here and say, Ben, you don't know the mess my life's in. You don't know the decisions I've made. I don't know the path out. I don't know it either, and you don't have to. All you gotta know is I want off this boat. And there's a God who made me that controls the winds and the waves and me, and I'm his. And if he has to wrap me up in the darkness to lead me to freedom, you do whatever you gotta do. but I'm yours. And so they throw him. They picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea stopped its raging. Then the men feared the Lord greatly. They offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. And then here's where the text ends. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the stomach of the fish 3 days and three nights. The fish is not a punishment. It's a rescue. God rescues him. Not with a piece of wood, because that could have been coincidence. Not with another boat. We threw him overboard and there was like a whaling ship next to him. Like, well, that's convenient. God does something crazy. And I read all these accounts of can a human survive in a whale, inside of a whale, and oh, that we found squids in here, an octopus, and is it technically possible? Yes, it's technically possible, but has it ever happened? Well, maybe it happened in the 1800s. I don't know. It's supposed to be crazy. The Bible doesn't record normal things. Normal's boring. The Bible only records really weird stuff. And it says, God appointed a fish. Why? So you know it's me. So you know I'm the one rescuing you. And that fish is the means of grace to lead you home, right? So to wrap up, I'll say this. Some people think Jonah is not the guy's real name because the name Jonah means dove. And that's not a compliment. Some people are like, isn't that the bird of peace? But for them, doves were silly little birds. Well, I mean, that would get trapped by some glass. That's who doves are. Like, just can't figure it out. And so some people look and go, Jonah was probably a nickname because Jonah's going to survive this encounter. And the story's funny. I mean, you made a mess of your life, bro. Sometimes it's not funny in the middle of it, but you can laugh at it later. And so a dove was a silly little bird that doesn't know where it's going. It's not a compliment to be called that. It'd be like if your nickname was Aquaman. Nobody really is like, oh, that's awesome. Like, it's not great to be called that. But I love that because the Hebrew people, on the Day of Atonement every year, the Day of Atonement was the day the people of God in the Old Testament would come and say, we're a mess, but God atones for us. God makes things right. Every year on the Day of Atonement, they would read the book of Jonah. And you know what they would do at the end? They would collectively say, I am Jonah. I am Jonah. And what they meant by that was, everybody runs. But praise God that he chases. And that's us. And the beautiful thing is, God doesn't throw you overboard. Jesus told the story of Jonah multiple times. Jesus loved this story. That's why I wanted to start here. It's because Jesus likes it a bunch. And you know why he tells it? Every time he does, he says, I'm like Jonah. Was he a sinner? Did he run? No. But he said, but I am going to get thrown into the storm of God's judgment for you. I'm going to be buried for 3 days for you. And then I'm going to rise and set you free. And the most unlikely means of rescue, a grave, will be the instrument to bring you life. A cross, an instrument of death that you're pinned to, will be your freedom. Jesus said, I'll be Jonah for you. You confess your sin to me. You confess you're a mess to me. I am Jonah. And he says, I get thrown into the raging sea of your life and I will make it calm. I will make it still. I will be the one that calms the winds and the waves and brings you peace. I will be the one who sets you back on dry ground and gives you a purpose and a future. I'll be the one who puts you back on the path God made you for. I will be the one who absorbs the chaos to give you calm. That's who Jesus is. I am Jonah, and praise God that Jesus is the Jonah who took the depths for us so that we might live and be free. Amen? Amen?
If you were encouraged by today's talk and believe it would be uplifting to others, then be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church podcast.